avoiding an all-out war in the Middle East.
The Gaza war is at risk of expanding, widening in at least three fronts.
The New York Times sues OpenAI and Microsoft.
So the Times is saying, hey, this is our intellectual property. It is our copyright, the literal right to reproduce and copy the work. It's exclusively ours, and we have all the rights to it. We created it, we paid for it, we own it. No one else has rights to it unless we grant them those rights.
And it's probably the most famous New Year's celebration in the world.
Happy New Year!
Getting ready to ring in 2024. Today is Thursday, December 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. As the war in Gaza grinds on, U.S. President Joe Biden is struggling to avoid an all-out war in the Middle East amid threats from Iran, continued strikes from Iran surrogates, and an Israeli leader talking about a long war with full force in Gaza. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadakasara has written about this on our website, voanews.com, and joins us now to talk about the most dangerous hotspots in the conflict outside of Gaza.
So the Gaza war is at risk of expanding, widening in at least three fronts. The first one is in the Israeli northern border with Lebanon, where there's skirmishes every day, increasing cross-border clashes with Hezbollah. This is another group that is backed by Iran, and it really is dangerous because tens of thousands of Israelis have been evacuated from that area, and it's really turning into what many Israeli analysts are calling an intolerable situation. And the Netanyahu government has said that military action is not off the table to ensure that Israeli citizens can return to their homes safely. That's one. Another one is, of course, the Red Sea, where we see the Houthi groups. This is also another Iran-backed group, is attacking the Red Sea, which is a waterways of a lot of international shipping. This is, again, as part of a solidarity from these groups to Hamas. So there's a lot of potential for escalation as these Iran-backed groups really compete to try to show their support for Hamas. And then the third one is really just a direct Israel-Iran war, particularly with the alleged assassination by Israel of Sayed Razi Mousavi. This is a senior advisor to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. He was killed in an airstrike in Syria that Tehran blames Israel for, but Israel has denied or has declined to confirm that it was behind the airstrike.
For President Biden, how thin is the tightrope he's on?
Oh, this is a very dangerous situation for President Biden. I mean, he is gearing up for the November 2024 election, and polls are already showing that most Americans disapprove of his handling of Gaza. But, you know, if you break it down, there's also Americans who feel that he is being too lenient on Israel and supporting Israel, and also those who say that he is not being strong enough. So he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadakasara. You can read her article on all of this at voanews.com. Hamas is a U.S. designated terrorist group. The New York Times has sued OpenAI and Microsoft. The Times accuses them of using millions of newspaper articles without permission to help train artificial intelligence technologies. Joining us to talk about this, what it means, why it's important, and how it affects the future of AI development and intellectual property rights is Ronald Bienstock, chair of Scarici and Hollenbeck's Intellectual Property Law Group.
Okay, so we should start with the basic premise that people really don't understand the intellectual property involved. So can we start there?
Sure, of course.
Okay, so let's start there. So the concept that we start with is that it's copyright. It's one of the three portions of intellectual property, if you will. We've got trademark, we get patent, we have copyright. So the Times is saying, hey, this is our intellectual property. It is our copyright, the literal right to reproduce and copy the work. It's exclusively ours, and we have all the rights to it. We created it, we paid for it, we own it, no one else has rights to it unless we grant them those rights. The next step is that they're saying to Microsoft and the companies that Microsoft is developing various software and AI programs and platforms for, is to say, you took literally all of our work and fed it into a computer without paying us, without compensating us, and you are creating our, from our work, information for people to access. And sometimes it's not accurate. Sometimes it's gone into what we call, you know, hallucinations, where the computer actually makes things up or editorializes on its own. So the Times is saying, we're 170 years old. We're the paper of record. We have developed our content over decades and decades of it with our editorial positioning and our editorial integrity to create this work. And we pay our people, and we pay, and sometimes they're in dangerous situations, and we pay them, we send them out to collect this information. We are scrupulous in how we put the information out to the marketplace, to the consumer, and none of that takes place if you take it from our hands, use it as you'd like, and it becomes something else.
So what do you think, what is the New York Times looking for in this lawsuit? They're not seeking a specific amount of damages, but they say that OpenAI and Microsoft has caused them billions of dollars in damages.
I think to some extent, that's a great question. I think some of it is unfortunately a little prospective, right? We don't really know what it will cost them. We can only guess, and prospective damages are generally not going to be allowed in any of these civil cases, right? You can't say we may be harmed. You have to have something. So there's an aspect to this that is a little less, there's a bit more amorphous. But the theory that the New York Times will be harmed is stated pretty accurately, right? We have paid for all this. You're not compensating us. We want you to make a deal with us. And apparently, they, according to the court paper, you know, the filings, the complaint, it says they're having some conversations which weren't apparently getting anywhere. I'm going to take that, you know, in the sotto voce moment to say, I think they were talking about license deals. It wasn't getting to be a high enough offer. And then the Times said, okay, we're walking away from the table. Into this.
Sure. I'd like to broaden it out a little bit, away from just the Times and OpenAI and Microsoft. Mm-hmm. What does this mean for the future? Not just the future of AI, but the future of human beings' intellectual property and artificial intelligence.
It's the 900-pound take your pick of animal in room. What is everybody thinking ultimately? That it's Hal and it's the movie, and Hal is going to say, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not, I can't do that right now, Dave. That eventually there'll be AI that is out of control from us, that it'll create everything, that the human creativity will be changed forever, and quite frankly, maybe limited, because it'll be impossible to insert actual creativity in a world where all AI creations have come from things before. Great example is all the money put into musical AI, which I find confounding, but okay, I think others are going to see, okay, I can see a profit. I put all the music from one or two composers, singer-songwriters, I put it all into a computer, and I say, give me the next record. Well, that means the expression of that composer or singer-songwriter is now out of their hands, and it'll sort of sound like them. It may be a reasonable facsimile, if you will, of them. It may sound like one of their songs. The lyrics may be as banal as June, Moon, and Doom. It may be just things that rhyme. We don't know. But now that composer, that singer-songwriter, has lost an audience, a loss of their career to an AI-generated series of pieces of music that third parties are investing in, so they can get the benefit of that work without having to ever compensate or give anything back to the original composer or singer-songwriter.
Which I guess sort of is what the whole actor's strike was about, right?
Absolutely. Think about that for a while. You know, most actors don't make the kind of living I think most people think, But if you are on a TV show and you have a very specific character, and a very specific voice, and a very specific look, and 10 years from now you're unavailable for all whatever reason that is, you're unavailable, according to previous to the strike, they could use an AI-generated version of you to sound like you and look like you, to carry on the character, and to create in the next 10 years a reprise, if you will, of that character without any compensation to you and without any credit to you, right? So if you're the actor, you walked on, you did a couple of shows as, you know, Mr. Smith, and then, well, that's from Lost in Space, bad reference. And then you go and they do the next show 10 years later, and they're not paying you, but they're using everything you've added to that. The whole, whatever your talent was that you brought to the depiction of that character, it's over. You've lost it. It's not yours anymore. It's theirs. We've been having these conversations about AI because I am fully convinced that people will take the easy way out and will create AI versions of things for profit, and there'll be a loss of whatever makes our arts so special, that it'll be perfect, right? It'll literally be perfect. Yeah. And we will lose the edge of what the creativity is, and we will lose the voices in the future to things that be much more banal. So, yeah, it is a moment of real reflection, and we're going to need to have some court decisions, even though we have some precedential decisions prior to this. We're going to need to have some court decisions that put some guardrails up.
Ronald Bienstock, the chair of Scarici Hollenbach's Intellectual Property Law Group. We're following these and other stories from around the world. Argentine police and demonstrators clash during a protest against 300 measures presented last week by President Javier Milei to deregulate the South American country's economy. Congolese police violently broke up a banned protest in the capital of Kinshasa on Wednesday, leaving several people wounded, when opposition leaders said more marches were planned against last week's vote. And protests against Serbian election results have entered their 10th day. The opposition group Serbia Against Violence has organized daily protests over the election results. Election observers say that vote was unfair. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Mexico's president to talk about finding some way to cope with the record numbers of people trying to reach the United States. As this meeting was taking place, thousands of migrants from Central and South America are making their way through Mexico in a caravan heading to the U.S. border. Veronica Villafañe narrates this report by Javier Hegar in Mexico City.
Thousands of migrants intent on reaching the United States spent Christmas walking toward the U.S.-Mexico border. Primarily from Central and South America, they had gathered for months in Tapachula, a city in Mexico's southeast state of Chiapas near the border with Guatemala. That was the starting point for the caravan's journey north.
There are children and women here with blisters on their feet, dehydrated. It is hard. It is hard to seek the American dream. What we are looking for is for the government to at least give us permission to cross.
The caravan set out on its journey north just days before a scheduled meeting between a high-level U.S. delegation and Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador to address the escalating flow of migrants in the region. According to Chiapas authorities, about 10,000 migrants, including children, are in the caravan. The migrants say they have no money to pay for visas or human traffickers, known as coyotes.
I don't have a single penny, and no one has given me a morsel of food. But I am determined. I'm not going to give up until I reach the border.
Joining the caravan of migrants is Luis Villagrán, director of the nonprofit Center for Human Dignification.
We only ask for what is within the law, the delivery of documents to be in the country legally.
During Wednesday's meeting, U.S. officials are expected to urge Mexico to stop more migrants at its southern border with Guatemala, while López Obrador is expected to ask the U.S. to send more development aid to migrants' home countries. In December alone, as many as 10,000 migrants were arrested daily at the southwest U.S. border. For Javier Egar in Mexico City, Veronica Villafañe, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. The Colorado River in the U.S. Southwest supplies the water for 40 million people and huge farms built in what would otherwise be the desert. But the river's water is not available to all. In the fourth installment of his series, River at Risk, VOA's Matt Dibble says some Native American tribes are still trying to get the water promised to them more than 100 years ago.
The Navajo Nation is the largest reservation in the U.S., and the Colorado River runs right along its western border. But for decades, the tribe has been unable to access water from the river. With other water sources drying up in the mega drought affecting the Southwest, many Navajos, like Ronald Attakai, now travel long distances to purchase water.
How often do you guys have to come and do this?
Twice.
Twice a day?
Yeah. We don't have running water, we have to haul water.
The long drive to the water station in northern Arizona costs $30 in gasoline each day. But this family, and many others in the western Navajo reservation, have no other option to get water. The tribe estimates that over one-third of the homes on its 71,000 square kilometer reservation lack running water. The 1922 agreement dividing the river's water between seven states also acknowledged the water rights of 30 Native American tribes, but the agreement failed to determine the amount of water each tribe should receive. Determining legally what that share should be is known as quantification and must be settled with the state where the tribe resides. The Navajo Nation has successfully negotiated Colorado River rights with Utah and New Mexico, but has yet to reach a settlement with the state of Arizona. There may not be much incentive for the state to settle, says law professor Heather Tanana, who is also a Navajo Nation member.
Tribal water rights count against the state's portion of Colorado River water. So each time a tribe is settling out some water rights in Arizona, it's going to count against Arizona and their portion.
Total tribal water rights would account for about a quarter of the river's average flow, which is more than what most states get. But without quantification agreements or infrastructure to move the water due Native Americans benefits other users, namely cities and big agriculture, helping sustain a system that was over-allocated from the very beginning. Some tribes, like Arizona's Gila River Indian Community, have opted to leave some of their share of Colorado River water in Lake Mead in return for federal funding to secure water from another source. The Navajo's water settlement case reached the Supreme Court in 2023. In a close decision, the court ruled that though the tribe has water rights, the government is not obligated to help quantify or deliver that water. The tribe is undeterred, says Tanana.
Had the government been found to have a responsibility to help the nation, we would have closed the water gap in Indian Country a lot faster. It'll still happen. We'll still get there. It'll just take a little bit more time and a little more determination.
In the meantime, thousands of Navajos will continue to visit stations like this one to get their daily water. Matt Dibble, VOA News, Page, Arizona.
And finally, as New Year's Eve approaches, New York City is getting ready for the annual celebration in Times Square. It may be the most famous New Year's party in the world. And Elena Wolf looks at the preparations in this story narrated by Anna Rice.
Seeing the old year out and ushering the new year in at New York City's Times Square is among the city's most beloved traditions, attracting locals and tourists alike. Every year, thousands of people head to the Midtown Manhattan Street Party to watch the ball drop.
Happy New Year!
In New York, 2024 came early. That is, the numerals that will light up the night sky when the ball drops. The digits traveled all the way from Los Angeles, arriving just days before Christmas.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Happy New Year!
For the next few days, people can go to Times Square to see the numbers up close and take pictures with them, before they are hoisted up to the 25th floor of the One Times Square skyscraper, right under the crystal ball that will drop on New Year's.
We've been dropping the ball in Times Square since 1907. The first New Year's Eve in Times Square was in 1904, which is when the New York Times moved to One Times Square. The subway came to Times Square for the first time, and Times Square was renamed Times Square from Longacre Square.
Another unchanged tradition of the last century is scattering confetti. But a little magic has been added to that tradition. City legend has it that if you write your wish on a piece of confetti and someone catches it, your wish will come true. People could write their wishes on confetti at Times Square, or they could submit their wishes online.
I think it'll be fun to have someone else will pick it up. Someone else might catch it and read it and then carry that into their new year as well. So I think that is a really cool idea.
Fernando lives in Brooklyn and likes to come to Times Square on New Year's Eve.
I was here last year. I was filming also. I was streaming to my YouTube channel.
Seasoned revelers say those who want to see the ball drop in person should arrive before noon to secure a good viewing spot of the iconic event, watched by thousands braving the cold at Times Square and billions more worldwide. For Yelena Wolf in New York, NRI's VOA News.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the U.S. State Department has repeatedly declared, journalism is not a crime. But the increasing number of journalists arrested in recent weeks in Azerbaijan show that Azerbaijani authorities do not agree. Starting in November with the arrest of the leadership of Absas Media, an independent anti-corruption media outlet, Azerbaijani authorities have escalated their repression of voices critical of the government. First to be detained in November was director of Absas Media, Ulvi Hasanli. Shortly after, its chief editor, Sevinç Vagivgize, deputy director Mohamed Kekilov, and journalist Nargis Absalamova were also arrested. They have been accused of what international human rights organizations say are spurious, politically motivated crimes because of Absas Media's investigative reporting on high-level government corruption. All are being held in prolonged pretrial detention. Also recently arrested are Aziz Orujov, founder of the independent online TV channel Kanal 13, and the channel's anchor, Rufat Muradli. It is not only journalists who are the victims of the government's repression. Gubad Ibaduglu, an economist and chair of the opposition Azerbaijan Democracy and Welfare Party, was arrested in July, and prominent opposition leader and government critic Tofiq Yaguglu was detained in mid-December. At a press briefing, U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller called the recent trend of detaining journalists, civil society activists, and opposition figures in Azerbaijan deeply troubling. Over a dozen such figures have been detained in just the last month. It is unacceptable, declared spokesperson Miller. We will continue to urge the Azerbaijani government to respect the human rights and fundamental freedoms of all, including those exercising freedom of expression, as well as call for the expeditious release of all those who have been unjustly detained.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.